Well, in this hour of Focus 580, we will continue with the topic that we began in hour number one. We're talking about the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, which took effect on January 1st of 1994. So now it's been 10 years. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, at the time that NAFTA was proposed and debated, there was a lot of controversy from people who were arguing that it would be bad for the American economy, it would be bad for American workers, and other people arguing that in just the opposite, that it would be good for the economy, that it would boost trade, it would actually create jobs because it would add incentive for manufacturing, for export. And now, 10 years later, the argument continues, and people are still taking the same positions and saying that, in fact, yes, it has been good, it has been bad. And what we wanted to do here, having passed the 10-year mark, is to have some conversation about NAFTA from a couple of different perspectives, from somebody who is generally critical, from somebody who is generally supportive. And in this part of the show, we'll be hearing from Dan Griswold. He is the Associate Director of the Center for Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. He specializes in the economic effects of international trade and immigration. He has contributed articles to a variety of publications, including the Wall Street Journal and the LA Times. He also has appeared on the NewsHour on PBS, on C-SPAN, on the BBC, on the Voice of America. He's also testified before the Senate Finance and Commerce Committees, the House Ways and Means and International Relations Trade Subcommittees, and others. He has a bachelor's degree in journalism from University of Wisconsin-Madison and also a master's degree in the politics of world economy from the London School of Economics. And he's joining us by telephone from Washington. As was the case with the first hour, questions, comments are certainly welcome. We do ask people, however, to try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can get in as many different people as possible and so that we can get in a lot of callers and keep the program moving. So questions are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So, again, here locally, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. If you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, or if you happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free, and that is 800-222-9455. Mr. Griswold, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure.
We certainly appreciate it. And I know that you and Mark Weisbrot, who was on the first hour, have had this experience before, although you've been together. I know you have debated one another a lot. We decided we kind of like this format a little bit better, so it's kind of like a virtual debate, I guess. So we really appreciate you giving some of your time. Let me ask, just as a way of starting with the general question that I put to him at the beginning, was can you talk about the effect that NAFTA has had on the economy of the United States?
I certainly can. And first, NAFTA, it's kind of like that old inkblot test, you know. If you don't like trade, you tend to read all sorts of negative things into NAFTA. If you think trade's a good thing, you tend to emphasize the positive. I think the mistake that was made about NAFTA is both sides exaggerated its impact. You know, Ross Perot saying there's going to be this giant sucking sound of jobs and investment going to Mexico, the advocates saying it was going to create hundreds of thousands of jobs. I think both sides somewhat missed the point. NAFTA was never going to have a large impact on the U.S. economy. Our economy is 17, 20 times bigger than Mexico's. Our trade barriers were already down to an average of like 2%. It was just not going to have much impact on this huge U.S. economy. The biggest impact was in Mexico, and we can talk about that in a moment. But basically, if you look at the record here in the United States in the last 10 years since the enactment of NAFTA, none of the negative things that the opponents said would happen have happened. The first 5 or 6 years after the passage of NAFTA were actually some of the best years the U.S. economy's ever experienced. We had record low unemployment, low inflation. We created millions of new jobs. In fact, in the first 5 years after the passage of NAFTA, we added 500,000 manufacturing jobs. Now, we've been coming out of a recession, but that had nothing to do with NAFTA. The recession started in 2000, years after NAFTA passed. It had to do with the dot-com bubble collapsing, business investment falling through the floor, corporate scandals, these other things. And NAFTA didn't play any role in that. So I think NAFTA, from the U.S. perspective, has been a modest success. It's made sectors like the automobile industry more efficient. We're producing just as many cars and light trucks today as we were before NAFTA, but we're doing it a lot more efficiently. We're producing parts in Canada and Mexico where they can do put them together more efficiently and bring it all together here in the United States. So I think NAFTA has been a first and foremost a foreign policy success for the United States, but also a modest positive economic success.
Let me ask you specifically a question about job loss, because there are people who do make the argument that there has been a loss of jobs directly attributable to NAFTA, and different people have different numbers. Some people say that it's at least a 500,000, and others make the argument that it's maybe like more over 800,000, and then some people say that it's even more than that. How do you respond to numbers like that, and what do you think indeed it is possible to say, yes, some jobs have been lost as a result of NAFTA?
Yes. Well, of course, trade will eliminate some jobs as it creates other jobs. And in some ways, that's the idea of trade. We do more of what we do best and less of what we don't do as well. Technology does that too, doesn't it? You know, think of all the jobs that the computer has eliminated, and yet it's created other jobs. But I would just say, take those figures with a grain of salt. About 400,000 people have applied, since NAFTA passed, about 400,000 people have applied for trade adjustment assistance, claiming that they were displaced because of NAFTA. Even if you take that figure at face value, that's about 40,000 workers a year. You know, David, 400,000 people apply for unemployment insurance every week in the United States, even when the economy is performing well. And so the jobs that were churned over because of NAFTA are just a drop in the bucket compared to the changes in the U.S. economy in healthy times.
Let me have you address a very fundamental point that Mark Weisbrot made in the first hour, and I think other people would make, and see what your response is. And it perhaps goes to this issue that you know, sometimes economic policies eliminate some jobs and create others.
Yes.
And his argument on other people is that what NAFTA has done is that it has contributed to a trend that we can't say this is just NAFTA alone, but it has contributed to a trend that perhaps we haven't so much lost jobs as the quality of jobs that people have, when you look at their wages and their benefits, has declined. So, in fact, maybe what we have done is we have eliminated jobs in manufacturing that were the jobs that paid well, paid a living wage, people could support their families, and we have replaced them with jobs in the service sector where the wages are lower and the benefits are much less favorable, if there are benefits at all. And again, I think he and other people would say, you can't blame NAFTA exclusively for that, but what NAFTA has done is simply made that worse.
You know, that's a seductive argument when we're in times of recession. And you notice whenever the U.S. goes through a recession, and they always seem to happen every 5 or 10 years, people come out of the woodwork and they'll say, oh, it's trade with Japan, or it's trade with Mexico, or it's trade with China that's doing all this. When in fact, one, I think it's really hard to argue that Americans have suffered a sustained reduction in their standard of living over the past 10 or 15 years. Americans, in many ways, were living better than ever. And you look at the current climate, if you're one of the 94% of the people in the workforce who have jobs, you know, mortgage rates are at record lows, inflation is quiet. So I think it's hard to argue that we're suffering some sort of sustained decline in our living standards. And secondly, it is a myth that only manufacturing jobs, or primarily manufacturing jobs, provide a middle-class living. In fact, today, the typical service job pays as well as the typical manufacturing job. Think of the millions and millions of jobs, middle-class jobs, in the service sector. You know, teachers, accountants, real estate agents, firefighters, policemen, managers, you know, it's not that we're not manufacturing anything anymore. In fact, since NAFTA, manufacturing output in the United States is up 40%. We're producing twice as much stuff in real value than we were in the 1970s. We're just doing it with fewer people because they're so much more productive. We've had these leaps in productivity, worker productivity, and that is the essence of long-term prosperity.
Well, let's bring some people who are listening into the conversation. We have a couple of people who have been here on hold already since we started. So let's go to Southern Illinois for the first on our toll-free line. Line four. Hello.
It is line four?
Yes.
Okay. I am from another country. I'm a professional. So I speak from that side, but also from the other side, the unskilled worker. NAFTA is a program created by the United States of America. We know that Mr. Bush and his friends, who most are very rich people. In fact, I happen to know a family that is friend. I am not rich, but this family are friends of Mr. Bush. They are very, very rich people. His friends are rich people. Do you think that Mr. Bush and his friends are going to lose money, lose power? No. Okay, the other issue, job loss. Well, I must say we're bringing skilled and unskilled workers from other countries. I'm not going to go very long on this, so I don't think I'm going to take over. We're bringing people from other countries, skilled and unskilled. The school worker, I am one. My bachelor degree was from my country. My master degree, I took it here through scholarship. Well, I don't know who I have to thank for that, but unskilled jobs. Nobody wants them. The American doesn't want the unskilled job, regardless of race. Regardless of nationality, background. My daughters are American, raised here. They would not take a waitress job. They would not take a factory job. No, they would not. They are university-raised children, fortunately. The bottom line, I want to say, NAFTA is a political tool for us. United States of America. I am an American. For us to continue to stay in power in the world. That is the bottom line that I want to say. How do you feel about that?
Well, Mr. Griswold, do you want to respond to the caller?
Yeah, she brought up a number of issues there, but it was Mexico that actually originally approached the United States back in the late 1980s to broach the idea of a free trade agreement. And that is because Mexico, as you know, used to have a very closed, centrally planned economy. All that came crashing down in the 1980s with the debt crisis, and Mexico basically spent a whole decade trying to dig itself out of that hole from that old failed system of trying to go it alone. And so NAFTA was really part of a broader strategy in Mexico to open themselves up to the global economy. They finally joined the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, in 1986. And they wanted to join the modern world, and NAFTA was part of that. So it wasn't something, it takes two to sign an agreement. It wasn't something the United States foisted on Mexico. And this is where I think NAFTA is most important for the United States as a foreign policy instrument. It helped to bring Mexico into the modern era. It was not a coincidence that within 7 years after passage of NAFTA, Mexico had its first competitive fair presidential election and elected a opposition party candidate, Vicente Fox, after 71 years of one-party rule by the PRI. NAFTA helped to break the monopoly on power of the PRI in Mexico and usher Mexico into an era of modern, outward-oriented free market development.
Well, Bush is managing Mr. Fox in whichever way he wants, just as he manages Britain, just like he manages any country in the world. And we are the power. We are the power in the world, and NAFTA is a tool to stay in power. That's my opinion.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call. Let's go to another person here. Our next caller is in Bloomington, Indiana, and that would be line number one. Hello.
Hi. Whatever NAFTA does for labor, it seems to me that it should be good for the consumer, the American consumer, because if consumer goods are made where wages are lower, the selling price for those goods will go down, and the American consumer will benefit. That's one thing I'd like you to confirm. If that's true, it seems to me it would be true. However, what concerns me is that in some of these low-labor countries, some of the labor conditions might be quite exploitive. In fact, I've even heard of slave labor conditions. What can we do, or what does NAFTA do, to not allow laborers to be exploited or slave labor to exist?
They're both good questions. And the first is one of those things that when people have argued in favor of NAFTA, they said, well, this is one of the benefits.
That's right. And that's why sometimes trade can be a hard thing to argue for, because you see the job losses. There are people displaced by trade, and that gets on the nightly news. What you don't see are the benefits that working families realize, tens of millions of working families realize. You know, we can buy better cars today because the process is more efficient, bringing Mexico into the process. Television sets are more affordable today, things like that. So families realize savings every day from NAFTA. It's like a tax cut for working families. About exploited labor, you know, working conditions in less developed countries can be appalling. The question is, would we do them any good by refusing to do business with them and by closing off opportunities they would have to make products for export? You know, the best-paying jobs in poor countries tend to be either multinational investments in those countries or companies that are producing for the export market.
It seems we have a little leverage. We could lean on them. If they're really exploiting their laborers, we could lean on them to improve their labor conditions, couldn't we?
Well, you have to be careful how you do that. You cannot end up punishing poor countries for being poor. You know, if we said we're not going to allow any goods to come in from countries that have labor conditions that we don't accept, in a sense, you'd be locking them into poverty. And the pattern that has happened around the world, when you look where real progress has been made against poverty, it has been in those poor countries that have opened themselves up to the global economy. China, Vietnam, India, Uganda, Chile, these are the success stories. On the other hand, it is pretty much impossible to find a single poor country that has made genuine progress against poverty by keeping their markets closed, by being hostile to foreign investment. So if we want to, one, just from a humanitarian point of view, help lift people out of poverty, we should do business with poor countries. But also, how are the people of China and India going to become consumers of U.S. products if we don't allow them to participate in the global economy? And in fact, China is now our fastest-growing major export market for U.S. goods.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Let me pick up again, take that question of the call a little bit further, because at the time that NAFTA was being debated, people did raise some of these questions. They said specifically they were concerned about, here I guess we're going to be talking about Mexico, they were concerned about conditions for workers in Mexico, their ability to organize and collectively bargain and so forth. And there was another set of issues that had to do with the difference between environmental laws of the two countries.
Yeah.
And so the side agreements were entered into as an accompaniment to NAFTA that was supposed to address those issues, work conditions for workers, and also environmental issues. And I think that some people have said those things, they weren't carried forward, that the promises to address those issues that were made at the time that NAFTA was signed simply haven't they haven't been kept.
I think that's debatable. You know, Mexico is not the United States. They had a long history of trying to go it alone, keeping their markets closed, having centrally planned economy through basically a one-party state, and that system just ran out of gas in the 80s. And so you can't blame all these problems that Mexico is still struggling with on NAFTA when all those problems predated NAFTA. I think what NAFTA has done, one, it has increased cooperation between the United States and Mexico. Our relations have probably never been better with Mexico, more cooperation on cross-border issues having to do with pollution. I think Mexico has made real progress. The air in Mexico City is slowly but surely getting cleaner. We're making progress in cleaning up issues at the border. Labor conditions have improved in terms of worker protections. You know, the best jobs in Mexico are in the north, in the maquiladora industries that are exporting to the United States. The problems they have in the south aren't because of NAFTA. They're because the southern Mexico is the least integrated part of Mexico. So, again, I come back to this basic proposition that how can we best help people in poor countries lift themselves out of poverty and raise their standards? It's not by closing our markets to the products that they can produce for export. It's by trading with them, and by trading with them, we help to lift overall living standards and raise environmental and labor standards in poor countries.
Well, let me, I got a caller here, and I promise them I won't make them wait too long, but let me make sort of take one further step here. I guess I was very struck as I was trying to read some of what had been written here just recently about NAFTA, how much of the reporting was not on the economic effect on the United States, but on the economic effect on Mexico.
Yeah.
And that initially the promises that were made, or the things that were said that NAFTA would do for Mexico, and that in fact some people argue that while the growth in Mexico, it has not been zero since NAFTA, it has been, I guess you would say, anemic, less than 1% increase per capita per year. And while there was an initial boom in manufacturing, particularly along the border in the maquiladoras, that in fact, in recent years, significant hundreds of thousands of jobs that were gained there have actually been lost, most of them to China, as, again, manufacturers go in pursuit of lower wages.
Yeah.
And so that the benefits in Mexico have perhaps been small, and they've also benefited mostly the people who live in the states in those areas in Mexico that are close to the United States, and there now has perhaps accelerated the sort of gap between people who live in the rest of Mexico, who are rural people, and those who live in those part of Mexico, those parts that are close to the United States.
Well, this is where figures can be very misleading. The opponents of NAFTA like to make generalizations about the last 10 years, and what they often don't acknowledge is that in the first year after NAFTA, and it was unrelated to NAFTA, but Mexico underwent a severe economic crisis, the peso crisis. You remember in the Christmas time of 94, the peso plunged, Mexico was on the verge of defaulting. That wasn't because of NAFTA. In fact, that was in some ways the last gasp of the old order. Mexico had been having economic crises virtually every six-year election cycle back to the 70s, in 82 and 88, again in 94. And so Mexican workers suffered a traumatic drop in their real wages in 94 and 95. And what happened is NAFTA allowed Mexico to bounce back quite a bit more quickly than it was able to dig itself out of the previous crash in the 1980s. So since 95 and 96, Mexico's actually experienced a growth rate that is relatively good for Latin America. Secondly, they broke out of this destructive cycle. They didn't have an economic crisis or meltdown in this last election cycle. Mexico's now one of the most stable economies in Latin America. You know, when there was all the talk about contagion and the financial crisis in East Asia and then Brazil and Argentina, well, Mexico's been pretty insulated from that. In fact, today, Mexico and Chile are the only two Latin American countries that have investment grades on their bonds. They have macroeconomic stability. They have the conditions for growth. And they're the only two Latin American countries, by the way, that have free trade agreements with the United States. That should tell you something. So Mexicans are not going to turn back. NAFTA is not an issue that the major parties are fighting over. They know the policies of the past failed. They want to move forward to a modern, open, democratic society.
Let us go and bring in here another caller. We have someone in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yeah, Well, what you just said about how their credit rating has gone up, to me that brings up visions of the World Trade Center, and it's being targeted. The U.S. is absolutely vicious in its way, in the way that it will destroy the credit rating of a country that doesn't agree to toe the line. And when you have Mexico and Chile now have good credit ratings, it's really
That's quite a charge. Can you give an example of a country whose credit rating we've destroyed because of that?
I would guess Cuba would be a good one.
You don't think Castro's communist 40 years of communism has had anything to do with that?
And you don't think our financial industries have put pedal to the floor in terms of destroying the credit rating?
We oppose the trade embargo against Cuba. We think if it served any purpose, it's long outdone that purpose, and it's hurting the United States and hurting the people of Cuba. But Cuba's problems fundamentally have to do with Castro's failed 40-year communist experiment. You know, communism failed in Russia. It failed in Eastern Europe. The Chinese and the Vietnamese can't run away from communism fast enough. I think to blame Cuba's problems on some conspiracy on the part of the United States, well, that's what Castro wants us to believe, but that just defies any objective look at the situation in Cuba.
Yeah, and our industries don't practically faint at the prospect of having trade with Cuba. Of course they do. But let me move on here. You're getting me stalled on a minor point, actually. Brazil's been watching what NAFTA's done to Mexico, and it's Brazil that's the big plum in South America, and it's Brazil that's digging in its heels here for very good reasons. I would direct people to a recent paper in the Foreign Policy and Focus website by a Ha-Jun Chang called Kicking Away the Ladder, The Real History of Free Trade, one of the most lucid papers I have ever read on this whole topic, where he points out quite clearly and supports it with great documentation that the historical picture is clear. When they were trying to catch up with the frontier economies, the now developed countries used interventionist trade and industrial policies in order to promote their infant industries. And in relative terms, many of them actually protected their industries a lot more heavily than what the currently developing countries have done, unquote. He also points out that the per capita income in developing countries grew at 3% per year between 1960 and 1980, but it's only grown at about 1.5% between 1980 and 2000. And even this 1.5% would be reduced to 1% if we take out India and China, which have not pursued liberal trade and industrial policies recommended by the developed countries. And lastly, well, I'm sure you respond to that, but let me point out that even theoretically, that one of the big reasons that people talk about free trade is this whole idea of comparative advantage. But as people have pointed out, and most recently Paul Craig Roberts at the Hoover Institution, their comparative advantage is meaningless in the context of mobile factors of production, and that's absolutely true. So I'll let you go at any of that, and I'll hang up.
All right, okay.
You've put a lot on the table. Let me just respond briefly to some of the more major contentions there. First, I don't believe the U.S. became prosperous because of our own trade barriers. Economists have looked at that, and we grew despite those trade barriers. The sectors of the U.S. economy that expanded the most rapidly when we had high trade barriers in the 19th century were not the protected sectors. Great Britain became a world power through free trade. So, I'd reject that. And you look around the world today, and those less developed countries that are growing the most rapidly are those that are moving towards freer markets, more openness to the global economy. Of course, China and India are not perfect examples of capitalism, but they are moving decisively in that direction. And you have places like Hong Kong, which has been free trade all along, and that has some of the highest standards of living in the world. So more and more developing countries are realizing that they can't go it alone. Opening up to the global economy is the way to grow. One last thing about Brazil's complaints. You know, I listen to what Brazil says, and there's a lot of truth in their complaints about the United States, but what they complain about is our trade barriers. You know, we have our highest trade barriers in the United States are against products that are most important to poor countries in exporting. You know, agricultural products, steel, footwear, textiles and apparel. Brazil's complaints are legitimate. We maintain high trade barriers on citrus, on sugar, on steel, on footwear. These are all very important to Brazil. Their complaint isn't against free trade. It's that we're not practicing what we preach here in the United States. And I say three cheers to Brazil for criticizing the United States. I think they could do more to lower their own trade barriers, which I think has inhibited growth in Brazil. So you can say all you want about these studies, what they miss. You know, it's quite an admission to say that India and China are the exceptions to that study that the caller cited. I mean, that is about half the world's population there, at least half the world's poor country population. And those countries have been moving decisively towards freer trade because they got tired of the stagnation and grinding poverty of closed markets and hostility to foreign investment.
Hmm. Well, now I guess I'm curious when you, I'm wondering about your sort of your idea, Cato's idea. Some people make the criticism that people here in the United States talk about free trade, but they don't really mean it. They mean free for us and not for anybody else. When you look at trade barriers to imported products into the United States, whether you're looking at tariffs or we're looking at quotas or you're looking at the kinds of price supports and legislation, all the kinds of the things that we do that to benefit our producers and manufacturers in the competition with foreign producers and manufacturers. Do you, when people say, well, that there we really don't have free trade, would you say, yes, that's right, we really don't? And you would say, we ought to take those barriers, we ought to be remove those barriers?
Yes. You know, to say that we don't have perfect free trade in this country is not a criticism of free trade. It just shows that, one, we're a democracy, and so you're going to have these kind of messy exceptions to good policy. But, you know, if you look at the U.S. trading system, we are one of the more open countries in the world. And again, you look around at the world, look at the rich countries that you see around the world, in Western Europe, Japan, East Asia. Almost invariably, the people who are the most well-off, and actually, incidentally, the most free politically, happen to live in countries that are generally open to the global economy. But we do have exceptions. I think it's rather shameful that here in the United States we have maintained our highest trade barriers against those products that are most important to poor countries. A World Bank study showed that the typical trade barriers in rich countries are four times higher against imports from less developed countries than they are against imports from other rich countries. I think we should address that. Those are the legitimate complaints made by Brazil and other developing countries at Cancun last fall. I think we should get those barriers down. And by the way, that is a movement towards freer trade. The complaint of the poor countries around the world isn't against free trade. It's that we're not practicing free trade, and they want more free trade. And I think we should accommodate them for their benefit and our benefit.
We have about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and I'd like to introduce again our guest, then we'll get right on to the next caller. We're talking with Dan Griswold. He is Associate Director of the Center for Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. He specializes in the economic effects of international trade and immigration. He's contributed articles to the Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times, other major publications. He's also been interviewed on radio, on television, both public and commercial. He has academic background both in journalism and economics, has a journalism degree from University of Wisconsin-Madison, and also a diploma in economics and a master's degree in the politics of the world economy from the London School of Economics. If you're interested, by the way, in finding out more about the Cato Institute, about the guests, about their positions on various issues, and you have access to the internet, they do have a website which is www.cato.org. So you can go right there. And questions and comments are welcome here this morning. We're talking about NAFTA. We thought, as it was 10 years now since the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement that went into effect January of 1994, it would be good to take a look at its effects and to talk about it from two different perspectives. And we have done that this morning on the program in the first hour, talking with Mark Weisbrot, who is generally critical, and in this hour talking with Dan Griswold, who is generally supportive. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Champaign County, line one.
Hi. I guess at the London School of Economics, they taught you that their wealth and development was based on free trade and not the fact that they had a worldwide empire and had gunboats around the country exacting whatever relations they wanted to have with the various colonies that they had for centuries.
That wasn't the basis of their prosperity.
Oh, no?
No.
Well, that's...
That was a drain on their resources.
You didn't
read Paul Kennedy.
Right, okay. That doesn't meet the laugh test, obviously. I mean, they lost money running the empire? Well, it might have transferred wealth from the middle class of their own country into the upper class, but it did construct a huge industrial system that was based on the pillaging of the world, and that's called imperialism. You're not allowed to bring that up, I guess, but I mean, there's so many examples. The Asian tigers, which are pointed at as some kind of free trade image, is just baloney. They were very authoritarian economies. The initial part of their development was the war economy during Vietnam. There's a history to all of this that you can't deny. I mean, I'm sure you will, but you're living in La La Land, and it comes up when you say that the past policies in the 19th century had nothing to do that are protected, our tariffs had nothing to do that it inhibited us. And then you turn around and then say, but we have all these tariffs now that we shouldn't have. And free trade is a myth. And most of NAFTA and the other trade agreements are actually about investment protection and all sorts of things like that. They have very little to do with trade. They have a lot to do with allowing corporations to be insured and transferring the productive capacity to these high repression and low wage countries, where the comparative advantage is having a state that will impose the conditions that are necessary to get people to work in the situations, and while the dumping of the corn from here is depressing the countryside of Mexico and forcing people to these so-called much better jobs in the free trade zones and the maquiladoras. It's ludicrous, and I don't know how you can possibly maintain a straight face on it. But
we'd like to abolish all the protections and subsidies to agriculture. You know, it's a scandal. The OECD's estimated the rich countries spend $350 billion a year subsidizing their agriculture, and this is bad for consumers in those countries. We pay higher food prices than we should at the grocery store for milk and other products, but it is very bad for farmers in poor countries, and they shouldn't have to compete against subsidized agriculture in rich countries. But again, that's not free trade.
Well, there are other voices in the third world. You keep saying that they all want, and we have these basically comprador regimes that are calling for free trade. That's the only option they have at this point, and getting rid of the subsidies. There are other people that are calling for authentic development investment, not just a World Bank that imposes. You know, they can't have the subsidies on their production because we got them by the debt crisis. We have them by the cojones, as it were.
Well, the callers again put several things on the table, but let me talk a bit about East Asia for a second. South Korea and Taiwan and other countries engaged in various forms of industrial policy. Was that the secret to their success? I don't think so. Lots of poor countries engage in industrial policy to one way or another, and they're still caught in poverty, and Hong Kong didn't engage in any industrial policy. They had pretty much a pure, hands-off, free trade approach, and they prospered. Now, and the caller is right that that part of the world hasn't been a fountain of democracy in the past, but look what's happened in South Korea and Taiwan and places like that. First, they rapidly expanded their engagement in the global economy. Yes, their exports went up, but their imports went up as well. That helped to create a more prosperous, larger, and educated middle class. And now, South Korea, Taiwan, increasingly places like Indonesia and the Philippines, are multi-party democracies that respect human rights. And by the way, I just did a study for Cato, which you can find on our website, looking at the effects of trade on democracy. And what you find are that those countries that are the most open to trade also tend to be the most prosperous and are the most likely to be democracies that protect human rights. And so when we pursue trade liberalization, it isn't just for our own economic benefit. It's to help till the soil for democracy and human rights around the world.
Let's take another call here. Someone who's calling from a car phone, mobile phone, south of Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I had a number of questions. First of all, about NAFTA. How is it, if we have free trade with Mexico, that NAFTA protected the sugar prices at about 22 cents a pound? And you can make sugar and ethanol a lot cheaper than you can corn, and of course it would be cheaper than corn syrup, all these products made here in central Illinois. How did that happen without any discussion? The second question I have is, drug companies like Roche, which are located in Basel, Switzerland, can charge one price for their drugs in Europe and come over here and charge three times the same price. That's obviously not free trade, and that's some kind of an institutional barrier that needs to be dealt with.
Yes.
That's all.
But those are a couple of very thoughtful questions. Yes, sugar was one of the exceptions to NAFTA, and I don't know why it should have been. In fact, our sugar program is another one of those scandals. It's one of those exceptions that's particularly scandalous towards from free trade. We have a domestically protected sugar price that is about three times the global price. The caller is exactly right. We pay 22 cents a pound domestically. The global spot market price is about 7 cents. And, you know, that is having an impact not just on consumers who buy sugar. We pay $1 to $2 billion extra a year for sugar. But it has an effect on U.S. industry. You know, right there in Illinois, Chicago in the past has had a number of candy and confectionery plants there. They've paid a heavy price for this high domestic price for sugar, and they've lost business. We've had factories move to Canada where they can import sugar for free, and now we're finding that sugar is complicating our efforts to open up markets abroad in free trade agreements that we're trying to negotiate with Central America and Australia. Sugar is coming up. The sugar lobby is very powerful. They're very well-funded, and they are basically extracting payment from millions of American families to increase the profits of a relatively small number of sugar-producing companies. Secondly, the drug issue, that is so complicated. You know, you get into intellectual property. One reason why we give monopoly protection to drug companies is to encourage research and development and innovation. And so there's a trade-off there. So I can't really say that's where it gets complicated. Yes, we have trade restrictions on drugs, but also you have safety issues, you have intellectual property issues. So that I'll just say that's a very complicated issue, maybe best left to another show.
All right, let's go again to another caller. This is Champaign, and it's callers on line number three. Hello?
Hello.
Yes?
I work with a Christian ministry here at the University of Illinois, and in a few weeks we are going to Juarez, Mexico, and cross the border with about 60 college students, and we will build homes for homeless people living on the border. These people have been brought to this area to to work across the street for Lexmark and for Toro and for these companies that line up and pay them $50 a week. And they live in cardboard checks. And I've always wished that I could take an economist along and and have them explain their thoughts. What do you think when you see something like that? These people living in the mud and under pallets and under plastic sheeting, eking out and then going across the street and having this zone of beautiful buildings with factories. Is this part of free trade? And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I was just down to Laredo, Texas last fall, another border town, and I agree with you. The contrast can be quite stark, but we have to ask, you know, did NAFTA and free trade create those conditions? And I would say no. You know, Mexico has had a lot of problems going back decades. They basically chose a fundamentally different path for much of the 20th century than the United States did. They kept their markets closed. They had a one-party state that dominated the economy, and in the end it failed. It crashed and burned in the 1980s, and now they're trying to pick up the pieces and move on a new course. And so I don't like those conditions any better than you do, but I think we need to be realistic about what caused them and what alternatives there are. And again, I come back to the point, would we do those people any good? Would those people in the cardboard shacks that you're going to minister to, and I compliment you for that, it sounds like a great program you've got there, would they be any better off if we kept our markets closed to those products that they can produce? I would say no. I think their best hope for raising their living conditions is to allow the market to work and allow them to create products that can be sold in the United States and raise their wages. Again, the best jobs in Mexico are those that tend to be in the export sector, that are working for foreign-owned factories located mostly in the north of Mexico and producing for export. So that is their best hope. Let's not extinguish that hope as well.
Thank you.
All right. I guess I find myself going back to the idea that what manufacturers have continued to do is pursue the lowest wage that they can. And the concern that I think some people in Mexico have raised is that some of the jobs that were created in manufacturing as a result of NAFTA have in fact now been lost. The figures I've seen are in the hundreds of thousands, and they have left Mexico, and most of them have gone to China, where wages are significantly less. Is there anything, now I don't know, you might argue that in fact that's just the way economics work, and that's not something that we should intervene in, but I guess I wonder what you think about this constant pursuit of, by manufacturers of the place where they can pay their workers the lowest wage.
Well, first, that doesn't prove to be true. You know, if low wages were all that determined where manufacturing located, the factories would be in Haiti. They'd be in sub-Saharan Africa. In fact, most of our foreign investment that goes abroad goes to other rich countries with high wages and high standards. They go to Europe. They go to Canada. Investment goes to Canada. Our investment in Mexico has actually been pretty modest compared to what we invest domestically. What companies are interested in are places where the workers are productive, where the infrastructure works, you know, the phones work and the electricity works, where the roads and transportation is dependable, where they can get products in and out of the country. So it isn't just low wages. And in fact, wages are becoming a declining part of the value of most products. Most products, the main value is in the technology. As far as Mexico competing with China, again, it's you have to look at the kinds of jobs that are going abroad, and China has a tremendous advantage in certain kinds of manufacturing, generally the lower end, consumer products and that sort of thing. I think Mexico is going to have to readjust and find its niche. You know, Mexico still is an integral part of, say, the U.S. automobile industry. You know, we're producing as many cars and light trucks in the United States today as we were before NAFTA, about 12 million a year. We're just doing it through a process that
creates some of the parts in Canada, some of the parts in Mexico, brings it all together here in the United States. So the answer isn't to close your markets. It's to engage in the global economy and do more of what you can do best. And that's the way that you lift wages and living standards.
The president has been talking about extending the principle of the free trade agreement to essentially to the rest of the hemisphere, first to Central America and then to all of the Americas. And there has been a lot of discussion of what has been called the free trade area of the Americas, a hemisphere-wide version of NAFTA. And again, people, I think, have raised some of the same arguments for and against that as they have to NAFTA. I'm assuming that you would be generally supportive of the idea of extending this to the rest of the hemisphere.
That's a more complicated question than it would first appear. You know, even free trade economists debate the best approach to free trade. Should it be a multilateral process through the WTO where everybody's on board and you have non-discriminatory trade liberalization, or is it better to go kind of piece by piece? And in some ways, the free trade area of the Americas is too unwieldy. You've got 34 countries. They're in different stages of development and readiness. I'm kind of skeptical that the free trade area of the Americas will come to fruition anytime soon. I'm much more in favor and optimistic about the Central American Free Trade Agreement. You know, let's look at those five Central American countries. When I was in college and into the 80s, that was a very tortured region of our hemisphere. You had insurgencies and civil war. You had widespread human rights abuses. That's a success today. The five Central American countries we've been negotiating with, Costa Rica, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, Nicaragua, all five of them today are functioning democracies. They have increasingly opened their economies to investment and trade. And I think a Central American Free Trade Agreement would be a way of reinforcing that very positive trend.
We're going to have to leave it at that. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Griswold, for talking with
us. Thank you. I've enjoyed